Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and we have a full house in the studio today. I'm joined by Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone. And pleasure to be here.
Hi. And Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Randy Olson.
Hello.
And for I think it's the third week in a row that we are so honored to have Charlie Hanley.
Yeah, good to be with you, Hope.
Yeah, so again, if you haven't listened to the other shows, Charlie is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, a former AP reporter, author of two books on the Korean War, one, The Bridge at Nogunri, and number two, which is coming out in August by Public Affairs, Ghost Flames. And Charlie will be reading from that book today, portions thereof. And today, we are continuing our discussion about the Korean War. Again, it's the 70th anniversary of the Korean War. We began this story with a foundational treatise by Bertha von Suttner called The Barbarization of the Sky. So the narrative that we're taking is looking at the Korean War through the sky and through the use of the air. And last week, we focused on the bombing of North Korea, and we're going to continue talking about that today. But today, we are taking a more philosophical approach, I would say, and looking at what is called in philosophy the epistemological dimensions of the Korean War. And in philosophy, epistemology is the study of or theory of knowledge. We talk about things like, how do you know when you know something? What is truth? What is a justified belief? And the Korean War, as we've been saying, is known as the Forgotten War. And we've been talking about that and these hidden stories that we'll talk more about. But that's where we're going today, to talk about more about this. Why is this forgotten? Why are these stories hidden? And the different techniques that are used to basically keep us in the dark about the details of the Korean War. So to begin, let's just make a distinction between this word forgotten and this word hidden. And I also want to say that really, if we forget something or something is hidden from us, I would say that's a kind of ignorance. And I also want to say that I think we have, you know, some younger, this is an intergenerational group of people on this show, and I think that a lot of younger people are totally ignorant about the Korean War, and not just younger people. There are many people who just don't know about this war. And Charlie, I remember you did a show on C-SPAN a few weeks ago, and there were a number of callers into that show. And if I recall, they were all men, and they all sounded like they were older men. And some of them were asking just rather basic questions, like, when were the Koreas divided and things like this. So indeed, I at the outset, I want to make a distinction between just not knowing something at all and then knowing something and forgetting it. These are two different epistemological states. I just wanted to make that distinction. Does anybody have anything to add about that? Going once, twice.
I mean, I'll just add a small piece here that, you know, in the event that there's an end in sight to knowledge, as if there's some function to it or purpose for it, it might be possible to use knowledge for the betterment of the future. Right? That's one possibility, at least. And if you don't have any information about a subject, you can't possibly use that information for the betterment of the future. So thus we have a possible reason to learn things. And, you know, this is a super rough epistemological theory, but it gets us moving anyway.
Thanks for that. Anybody else on this? Once, twice. Okay. So to get us rolling, I'm going to play a clip from, again, we played a clip from Bruce Cummings last week. He is a professor at the University of Chicago and an infamous scholar of Korea. And this clip actually is from a webinar that he gave on June 25th of this year, and we have put this webinar on our show resources page if you want to watch the whole webinar. But here he's asked a question, and he answers, and his answer, as you will see, includes this sort of claim about the ignorance of the American public about the Korean War and bombing in particular. So here comes the clip. It's about 2.5 minutes long.
There's a really interesting question here. What is one key fact you wish more South Korean and North Korean people would realize respectively about the Korean War that's not often discussed within their own domestic narratives or historical memory?
Well, I did a picture book with John Halliday back in 1988. I got these photos on the Korean War out of the American archives mainly. And it was at that time that I realized what an unholy slaughter the war was for civilians. With South Korea, as I said earlier, probably killing as much as 500,000 civilians before and during the war for political reasons. North Korea, because their enemies were much fewer, frankly was less violent in terms of massacres, but if you were a landlord or a policeman who served the Japanese, you were in a lot of deep trouble in North Korea. And then the U.S. just blatantly bombed the hell out of North Korea without any limits. Napalm was used all over North Korea. Hardly a building, a modern building, was standing at the end of the war. Most cities were razed to the ground. Probably 2 million people died in that bombing campaign, which was similar to what we did to Germany and Japan in 1943-44. But North Korea had about 16 cities, and they were wiped out to a greater degree even than the firebombing in Germany and Japan. Now, this should be common knowledge in the U.S. I'd say two things that happen to me when I give lectures around this country. If I talk about the bombing, as I just did, people come up to me after the lecture and say, I've never heard of anything. This is really something. Wow, napalm was used all over the place. And the second thing is when I talk about nuclear weapons in South Korea, I still have people coming up saying, are you sure that there were American nuclear weapons in South Korea? Where'd you get that? I mean, it's almost as if there's a blanket of ignorance in the U.S. about Korea and the Korean War. But for South Koreans and North Koreans, I just think the horrible bloodletting that all sides engaged in just tells us we can never have another internecine war in Korea.
All right, so that's the clip. And again, that's Bruce Cummings on this webinar. You can access this on our show resources page at Virtues of Peace. So he says something like there's this blanket of ignorance about the Korean War amongst the U.S. public. And so, again, it seems like the people who are going to Bruce's talks know something about the Korean War. It's just these particular stories about the bombing and the use of napalm, et cetera, are unknown to them. So this is a different. It's not that the Korean War is just they're totally ignorant about it, but specific stories. So we're going to be talking more about that. And these stories are unknown, become unknown in a number of ways. And one is that they're deliberately hidden. And so to talk about that, Charlie, you have a couple of stories to share about stories that were deliberately hidden from the public. Can you talk about one from August 1950?
Sure. And, you know, perhaps before I get into that, Hope, I'll point out something else as sort of a subset to this forgotten versus known business, and that is many of these things obviously were known to the people in South Korea who experienced them, but for decades under an authoritarian regime, they were deathly afraid, literally deathly afraid of talking about them. And I'll always remember speaking with a South Korean historian, a middle-aged fellow, but as a young scholar, I guess this would have been in the 1980s, 1990s, as South Korea is liberalizing, he's going through the records and coming to realize what Bruce Cummings referred to, that hundreds of thousands of political prisoners or supposed political prisoners were executed en masse by the South Korean government early in the war. And this historian told me, he said, I looked at this and I said to myself, Jesus Christ, this is my country. I can't believe it. And this is a fellow who grew up and was well-educated in South Korea. And only by digging into some obscure records did he begin to understand what actually had happened. So the South Korean people were kept in ignorance for decades about these things. But since approximately, well, the late 90s in particular, and the Associated Press exposure confirmation of the Noguenri massacre of refugees by the U.S. military, this played a big role in unleashing a lot of information about the war, these hidden aspects of the war. And so there were many, many examples, but I'll just explain a couple of them. One, as you say, this was on August 3, 1950, this event, about the six weeks into the war. And the American and South Korean troops are retreating across the Naktang River into their defense line on the east bank of the river called the Pusan Perimeter as the North Koreans are advancing. And my AP colleagues, what the Americans were doing was they blew up the two bridges across the Naktang to deny them to the advancing North Koreans. And my AP researcher, Randy Hirschaft, discovered that an American general had confessed to an Army historian years later that that when he blew up one bridge, it was filled with refugees. And up in the what he told him was up in the air with the bridge went hundreds of refugees. We therefore had reason to suspect, Randy and I, that the same had happened at the second bridge downriver at Tuksangdong. We found there were news stories that mentioned the blowing of that bridge at the time, an Associated Press story and a New York Times story, but they mentioned nothing about refugees being killed. We found the report, the daily reports, the journal of the engineers unit, the U.S. Army engineers unit that blew up the bridge, and their only comment in their report was, quote, results excellent, unquote, not a mention of refugees. But Randy obtained the rosters for that engineers unit, and we began tracking down some of the veterans, some of the men from the unit. And the first one we tracked down, the easiest to track down, was a fellow who was actually quoted in the AP and New York Times stories at the time describing the blowing of the bridge. But again, these stories did not mention refugees. We found him, his name was Rudy Gianelli. We found him in Florida, and I spoke with him. And I said, do you remember this day? And he said something to the effect of, do I remember it? Oh, my God, all those poor people blown up. So then he went on from there. And we found other veterans after Rudy. But when I hung up on Rudy that first day, I put the phone down and I said, wait a minute. I got to call him back. I called him back. I said, Rudy, do you remember talking to these two reporters, these two American reporters? And he certainly did. He spoke with him because his colonel had told him, go help the reporters out and tell them what happened. And I said, well, Rudy, did you tell them about the refugees being blown up on the bridge? He said, sure. He said, that's all I talked about was the refugees. So these two American reporters had suppressed the truth of this event, that clearly hundreds of refugees were killed on that Tuksangdong Bridge. The press at the time, the American press at the war front, they were not under direct censorship, but they were to abide by a policy whereby they could not bring the U.S. military into disrepute, was the word that was used. If they did, they would lose their accreditation and be booted out of Korea. But in any event, we found three other engineer veterans who also recounted and confirmed that, yes, indeed, they blew up hundreds of refugees. The bridge was 650 feet long, and these fellows told us it was packed end-to-end with refugee families trying to get across. As it happened, the North Koreans didn't even show up in that area until 3 or 4 days later. So certainly something could have been done to save those people. An interesting point here is that when we speak about truths being unveiled after many years, the official history still tell lies about these things. The official U.S. Army history, for example, does not acknowledge the blowing of that the refugees were blown up on the Tuksangdong Bridge. And another example, if I may, hope, of this sort of thing being coming out much later, and there are many, many examples. But this one involves the British journalist Alan Winnington, who was correspondent for London's communist newspaper, The Daily Worker. And Winnington is one of 20 featured individuals in my upcoming Korean War book that you mentioned, Ghost Flames. He was based in Peking and was there for the communist victory in the Civil War in 1949. And when the war broke out in Korea, he went over into Korea and went south with the North Korean army, with the invading army. And so now it's late July 1950, and he has reached the city of Taejon. And people there in the north, in other words, the North Koreans have captured Taejon as the South Koreans and the Americans retreat. And people in Taejon tell him that there was a very big slaughter outside of town, and he was taken to a valley outside town where villagers told him what had happened earlier in July, that the South Korean police had made these villagers dig these very large pits, very long, deep pits outside their village. And then soon trucks began arriving with these prisoners who'd been taken from jails in Taejon. And these were the political prisoners. Some of them were indeed politically active. Some were sort of duped into joining an organization that was a re-education organization that the Southern government had established for supposedly converted leftists who had renounced their political beliefs, but they were forced to join this organization. In any event, there were some true political activists. There were others who were just haplessly caught in this thing, and there were some common criminals who were just taken from the prisons. They trucked these prisoners out to this area and lined them up prone on the edge of the pits, of the ditches, and shot them in the head and dumped them into these pits. The villagers told Winnington, the British communist reporter, that these were usually American trucks with American drivers and that American officers were present at these mass executions. And so Winnington is now at the scene himself. And let me read from Ghost Flames, if I may. Mm-hmm. Alan Winnington has walked into the midst of a nightmarish vision. He proceeds slowly down a slender, solid path between long pits of loose earth. Waxy, putrefying hands, legs, skulls protrude through the surface. A stench of death sinks deep into his throat. As he walks the narrow path down the valley, Winnington peers into fissures in the rain-washed earth, seeing unidentifiable messes of rotting flesh, heads blown open by bullets, wrists bound with wire. He paces out the six pits, which measure from 30 yards to 200 yards in length. He takes photographs. He collects U.S. cases. He picks up empty cigarette packs, Lucky Strikes, where he's told the Americans stood. The group finally retreats, wordless and stunned. Winnington sees his escort, Pak Bung Min, sitting with a local woman whose son's remains lie somewhere in the valley. Both are weeping. Comrade Choi then informs Winnington that Pak's wife was among the political prisoners in the Taejon prison. And now he nods toward the mass graves. So now, Hope, what happens is that Alan Winnington files his report back to the Daily Worker in London, where it's published, and he's written that thousands were horribly butchered. He compares what he saw to the Nazi death camps at Belsen and Buchenwald, and he describes the American role that he was informed of. The U.S. Embassy in London immediately denounces this report as what it called an atrocity fabrication. And the State Department manages to extract an official denial from the South Korean government. But the fact is that the U.S. military knows it's true. Well, as I said, the villagers told Winnington American officers were there. Well, lo and behold, these American officers actually took photos, a series of photos of one mass execution. And they were sent back to the Pentagon in Washington with a memo that said that thousands of political prisoners were executed in the war's first weeks. And this material was simply stamped secret and hidden away in the military archives. And that's where they stayed for 50 years. But in the year 2000, a Korean researcher managed to get the photos declassified. And we at the AP were tipped by him, and we also got copies of the photos, and we published a report on the mass killings. But again, on this as well, the official army history still suppresses this truth. In fact, the official army history blames these bodies were acknowledged in the official army history, these mass graves, but blamed it all on the North Koreans rather than those who actually perpetrated it, the South Koreans. So those are two, I think, good examples of how the truth of that war, so many truths of that war, that what we call the dark underside of the war, was hidden for half a century, in effect, but only lately has begun to emerge.
And let me just make a comment on that, and then I'll ask anybody else if they want to comment. But one thing that's so striking and connecting these stories and the story about the massacre of political prisoners, which sounds like the Einsatzgruppen case where you had just thousands of victims lined up in front of a pit, mainly in Russia, if I recall, and mass graves. So it sounds like that. But this fact that it's not really confirmed until a historian goes digging and finds these photographs. And in Bruce Cumings' clip, he says, you know, he didn't realize what an, I think it's some like unholy slaughter of civilians. I think that's how what he says. Until he did this picture book with, I think, John Halliday, and he went into the archives and found these photos. And so there's two things here that are really important, and one is this, like, the importance of going into archives to unearth the truth, and the importance of photographs in helping us to understand the truth. And that bit about photographs, I would be remiss if I didn't give a nod to Virginia Woolf's 1938 essay, anti-war essay called Three Guineas, where she basically says, look, we have a lot of disagreement about the facts, but here's a picture, and here's a picture of a house that's not standing anymore, and here's a picture of a burned child's body. And so let's just look at these facts and start to talk about war by looking at these pictures. Anybody else have anything to say about these hidden stories and how they were unearthed finally? Going once.
One thing.
Going.
Go ahead.
Michael, go ahead, and then Randy.
Oh, thank you. One thing that I have found really shocking and surprising from coming to understand this dark underside of the war is that throughout everything I've read about people who have traveled to North Korea and all these news reports that are done, they are always taken to these places like the Victorious Fatherland Liberation War Museum in Pyongyang, and they're preached to by these tour guides who say all these like horrible atrocities occurred during the war in which the Americans were either complicit or helped to perpetrate. And it was always this sort of disbelief and just complete, oh, that's just like North Korean propaganda trying to deface the United States. But then it's really, well, yes, it's most certainly probably a great deal of propaganda, but also a grain of truth tied in as well. And I find that if such this dark underside were to be more widely known, that it would lend credence to what one side of this war has really never forgotten all along.
Cool. Randy?
Yeah, I wanted to return to this idea that we started with about like the reason why we're looking at these stories and try to extract out or perhaps distill down some utility so that it's not just like throwing ugliness and atrocity, you know, on top of people without an explanation. And so in order to do that, I have to do a little loop, but bear with me. This idea of like reconciliation, this idea of healing presupposes that we have information about an event that, I mean, everything that we've gone through so far is clearly indicative of a traumatic series of events over many years. And, you know, these are individual examples of a series of atrocity. And one of the things that has been true in my life as an individual is that while I wasn't perhaps fully conscious during the moment where an event was taking place, once I had sufficient, you know, time between then and the, you know, eventual moment where things became reconciled, there was this ability where a person can look back with new information, with greater vision, with greater understanding, such that, you know, we use the cliche of like hindsight is 20/20, but like perhaps we didn't know that it was super, super unacceptable to do the things that we were doing during the Korean War, and we have something to amend for, we have something we have to do in order to bring a conclusion to this part of American history and a part of our collective consciousness, which there's no way we can really move forward in a way that isn't completely corrupt if we don't acknowledge these moments that are definitely a black spot on like the history of our country. Like I know that I couldn't be comfortable espousing certain forms of patriotism if these things were not addressed and acknowledged in the collective consciousness of the United States.
Yep. Go ahead, Taylor.
Well, you know, I would just point out the obvious, and that is the U.S. government has never acknowledged these dark undersides of any war. For example, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. There never has been any official apology. Of course, there was acknowledgement of that, at least, after after people in Congress began inquiring about what happened. But no apology, no restitution, no compensation. The same with our Nogunri massacre in the Korean War. They were forced, the U.S. Army was forced by the Associated Press reporting to investigate, or quote-unquote investigate, but in the end, incredibly, claimed that this was not a deliberate killing over 3 days of screaming women and children, and of course did not issue an apology and did not issue any compensation. And as I noted, for example, the Center for Military History, the Army's historians, have not acknowledged, have not included information about the massacre and these other events in their official accounts of that war. I don't know about the Vietnam War, whether My Lai made it into the official history or not, I have to confess, but I know a lot about the Korean War, and these things simply didn't appear.
Taylor, did you want
to? I would also add that I think it's important for us to know our own history, both the positive and the negative, but our government tends to focus so much on the negative of other countries, and I think that's true of most governments as a way to influence the population to otherize other countries and the citizenry of other countries. So at least in the U.S., I know a lot of times you're reading about atrocities, you're not reading about American atrocities. And like that can be used to sort of dehumanize other groups of people and enable, you know, militarization and sort of this fervent nationalism that that they can use to kind of instigate war. So I think it is important that we acknowledge our own history, so that we don't repeat the past.
Yeah,
and if the government if the government is not going to acknowledge and apologize and compensate, et cetera, then it's left to the press, a free press, and to historians, academics, et cetera, to make sure people are informed.
Mm. And
informed completely, right? Because, I mean, suppose you have an injury and you go to the hospital and you point out that, yes, well, I was in a car accident, but you fail to tell the people in the emergency room that you also have a gun wound. You know, they're going to find out eventually, and then that problem may need to get addressed in order for you to not die. And, of course, this is an extreme example, but the point is, if we don't have the information, there's no possible way of us coming to terms with it appropriately. And if we don't come to terms with it appropriately, it festers, and the wound doesn't just go away because we don't want to look at it.
Yeah, I want to build on that point and also connect it to this. One of the reasons why the Winnington report was denounced, and it connects to something that Michael said, so I'm going to try to tie it all together. But this idea that to properly reconcile, we need to have all of the information, and the information really is very, very specific in some cases. And this another report that I want to mention that was also denounced because it's communist propaganda, and this is on our show resources page, is this report that the an international women's group, the Women's International Democratic Federation, submitted to the United Nations and every government, and there was a fact-finding mission that was sent to North Korea in 1951, a delegation of women, and you can read their report. And I want to draw attention to one of the things they say in their report, because they talk a lot about the bombing, the indiscriminate bombing. I'm just reading from the report. More homes have been destroyed than military objectives. This war is a war on life itself. And this investigation of the commission shows what war means to the civilian population, particularly to women and children. And they talk about how because of the bombing in the north, families were forced to live in what they call dugouts, basically holes in the ground. And so basically everything went underground in North Korea because of this bombing. And to Randy's point, like to completely reconcile, we have to acknowledge all wounds. And this includes not only understanding our atrocious behavior, but also the, you know, the psychological impact of living in a hole because, you know, another country is indiscriminately bombing. And so when you think about that, and this report uses the word humiliation, that there's a special humiliation visited upon the Korean women and their legendary heroism. And I think this is a point, so I've made this point in other areas, but that this is also something that we have to understand, that with this bombing comes like living in the ground, and this is a kind of humiliation involved in that. And I couldn't help but think of, you know, the movie that won the Academy Award for Best Picture this year, which is this movie Parasite, about people who are living underground. And this idea of being below the earth is degrading and dehumanizing. And so I just wanted to draw attention to that, and that this report, too, was totally denounced as communist propaganda. But you read the report, and there are a lot of things are can be corroborated independently. So to Michael's point that, okay, well, perhaps there is some propaganda going on, and this is being used by the state to demonize another state. But there is some truth to this, and in philosophy, we have a thing called fallacies, and there's something called ad hominem, which means against the person, against the man. And the idea is that you delegitimize a position by talking about the bad character of the person advocating it. So it's a kind of ad hominem attack on this report. It's like, well, it's just propaganda. Well, how about independently verifying the claims? And the other thing is this report, although the one on the show resources page does not have photographs, but the original report does have photographs of villages destroyed and so forth. So there again is the photographs that are very difficult to disagree with. Anybody else before we talk about some more of, we've been talking about this hiddenness and the importance of doing this archival research and digging into obscure records and photographs that haven't been seen. Anybody else to final thoughts before we transition?
I would highly encourage anyone interested in gaining a fuller insight into this war in general to read the WIDF report. I, from my personal experience of reading it the other day, it was truly jarring and shocking, and the extent and its thoroughness was really impressive. And there was many moments reading over some of the atrocities that had been committed against these people, very personal attacks on them and their family that I would have to stop and back away from it. So no, it was very worthwhile.
Yeah, it really does read like a fact-finding. You know, if you have any experience with like international commissions or even, you know, law and the importance of finding facts and specific people and specific incidents. And if you read this report, it's like specific names, blah, 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 at this address. And, you know, it's down to the nitty-gritty details. Please check out that report. Do note that the report that's on the show resources page is a transcription. There's a couple of things that are missing from it, but including pictures. There's also a little bit of text missing from it. Hey, you know, one of the messages here is do your diligence and find the real report if you want to look at the whole thing. So this other aspect of the way that a story becomes hidden is a little bit more, it kind of connects to what we're talking about in terms of labeling something as purely propaganda. But this idea of classifying something, like improper classification, and the title of this show is something like, don't call them villages. They are military targets. And this is, I'm taking poetic license from a memo that Charlie will read for us. I want to say that this memo is also on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. But the idea here is that the way that you describe something, the adjectives that you use, sort of set up how you're imagining that. And there's this like deliberate decision to not use certain descriptors so that the horrors are not fully known. So, Charlie, could you read this memo for us?
Sure. This is something that Randy Hirschhaft, our EP researcher, turned up at the National Archives, the classified documents. It's a message from the Pentagon in Washington to the Far East Command in Tokyo, and it's dated 15 August 1950. And it's from the Chief of Information of the Army in Washington to the Public Information Office of General MacArthur's command in Tokyo. And it refers to it gives a number for a specific communique from MacArthur's press office. In other words, a press communique announcing, reporting some actions. And the message reads, "There is a tendency in communiques to report bombing missions as having damaged or destroyed a warehouse, village, etc., without attaching some adjective which would identify it as a military target. This has caused considerable comment and furnished ammunition to rumors that there is promiscuous bombing in Korea. Strongly recommend that targets be identified as military targets. Qualifying adjectives of some sort. Have asked Air Force and Navy to present this idea through their channels." And then it's signed Parks, and that was General Floyd Parks, who was the Army Information Chief. Now, interestingly, Hope, this is 15 August 1950, and it says that there were rumors of promiscuous bombing in Korea. The very next day, the 16th, one of the most amazing air attacks of the war took place. The U.S. Air Force sent dozens and dozens of bombers to drop more than 3,000 bombs on a 27-square-mile area of South Korea across the Naktang River from the U.S. defense lines. It was carpet bombing, just totally indiscriminate carpet bombing with grids laid out on the map. And squadrons of bombers assigned to each grid, and just drop all your bombs in on this grid. Just devastating impact of more than 3,500-pound bombs, and then a couple of 100,000-pound bombs. So there's no doubt that there was indiscriminate promiscuous bombing going on, not just in North Korea but in South Korea, and it wasn't just a rumor, as General Parks would have it.
Yeah, and I just want to remind everyone that I think it was two shows ago we talked about this this draft resolution that was proposed by the Soviet Union to the UN Security Council, and that was on August 8th, 1950. And just reminding everybody what the title of that resolution was, which didn't go anywhere: Proposal Concerning the Inhuman, Barbarous Bombing by the United States Air Force of the Peaceful Population, Towns, and Populated Areas in Korea. So, right, I mean, this was being decried. And so there's that fact, and or the philosophical point that we're making is that, you know, calling it a military target instead of a house or a village is this other way to hide what we're really doing. And so pay attention to how things are being described. And there's a whole industry that exists to call things by names that don't incite certain emotions. So extraordinary rendition for waterboarding, forms of torture, for instance. So anybody on this point before we transition to some passages from Ghost Flames? Anybody on this point about the adjectives that you use can obfuscate the truth?
I mean, I'll point out the obvious that, like, this is deception, right? It's lying. Mm-hmm. And just because it's, you know, there's like this gradient where on the extreme end, it's like, you know, something is false, and then you say, then, you know, you treat it as if it's true. And that being like the ultimate, like the furthest lie you can make. And then, you know, somewhere between there and the truth is where people operate. And it's like, really, if we're not calling things as they are, and identifying them with appropriate labels, we're just lying. And this is something that is everyone's responsibility, right? This is the responsibility of the people presenting the information, whether it's through, like, the press or through military or through, you know, when we tell a story about the thing that we read in the paper the other day, right? It goes all the way down to the level of the individual. And there's no place where the transmission of information can be falsified in a way that does not create long-standing damage for someone else to clean up. And so now we're in the process here of trying to retell a story that was told falsely many times for a very extended duration. And, you know, there's no easy way to do it, because we have to, like, clean up a bunch of misconceptions and a bunch of lies in order to get just the basic, like, well, yeah, these are the things that happened. Here's the unbelievable pile of facts that can corroborate this set of evidence. So now can we start to talk about, you know, like, that's like the task at hand. And
Hear. Anybody follow up with that? Okay, so at one point you said something about, like, getting to this, like, more individualized, I think you said eyewitness, maybe not, maybe I'm building, I'm priming myself, but eyewitness accounts. We made this point last week. So the telling of the story from the actual, like, a person who's on the ground, qua civilian, qua mother, qua child, not qua military official, right, is going to have, like, a different description of the events. And we need to consider that when we're engaged in uncovering the truth of these stories. So you really have to drill down to specific documents and archives and these eyewitness testimonies. And again, I'm so, you know, happy, honored to have Charlie read from his new book some of these eyewitness accounts. So, Charlie, can you share with us some of the eyewitness accounts that you will find in Ghost Flames?
Sure. And my purpose in writing Ghost Flames was to tell the story of the Korean War through the experiences of the 20 people that I feature, and they're of all nationalities involved, and civilians and soldiers alike. And the first I'd like to read, and my these readings, these passages all relate to bombing, American bombing of North Korea in the first months of the war. And this is in July 1950. The war, of course, started June 25, and this is mid-July of 1950. And this is a little earlier in our character, Alan Winnington's experience in Korea. He's arrived in Pyongyang from his base in Peking, and he quickly drives over to Wonsan, which is a port on the east coast, in the southeast corner of North Korea, where there has just been a massive bombing. And so from the book, from Ghost Flames, Alan Winnington has now come to Wonsan. Entering the city's north end, the British journalist, his driver, and his Chinese-speaking Korean escort are stunned at what they find. In their bulky Russian sedan, at the end of a 120-mile journey across the peninsula from Pyongyang, they drive down streets lined with collapsed and burned houses and past desperate residents collecting what they can from the ruins. In his first dispatch from Korea back to London's communist Daily Worker, the correspondent reports he is told more than 1,000 homes and other buildings have been destroyed in Wonsan, and 1,249 people killed, mostly women and children. The largest girls' school, the center of the working-class district, and the primary school on the seashore were hit, he writes. He speaks with a man named Juan, whose wife and children were killed while he was at work. He tells Winnington life is no longer worth living, except I would give my last drop of blood to get revenge and drive those murdering dogs from our country. And hope this is just the beginning of the devastating bombing of North Korea. Later in July 1950, one of the cities hit hard is Chongjin in the far northeast corner of North Korea on the Sea of Japan. This bombing is witnessed by two of my book's featured individuals. The first is No Kum Suk, an 18-year-old cadet at the North Korean Naval Academy. The academy's staff and students are now being sheltered in caves and tunnels outside Chongjin to avoid the American planes. The second character, who is also 18, Chung Dong-kyu, he's a student at the medical school in this very city of Chongjin. Now, from the book, a late July morning, 1950, No Kum Suk and Chung Dong-kyu witnessed the bombing of Chongjin. Just past dawn, Cadet No Kum Suk is on sentry duty on a mountaintop, just uphill from the cave that now houses his second-year class of North Korea's Naval Academy. The cadets moved there on the northern outskirts of Chongjin after an American air attack destroyed the academy buildings in the port city. Around 6:30, he spots the silvery glints flying low up the coast, wave after wave of U.S. Air Force B-29 Super Fortresses. They begin at the city's southern edge, dropping 500-pound bombs methodically in a line, carpet bombing, destroying everything below. Then the next wave sweeps in, stitching bombs along the next line farther north. From his lofty perch, No watches in horror. Hears the whistles of the diving bomb, sees the flash and smoke, hears the endless explosions. The ground beneath him trembles, and the 18-year-old cadet is shaking uncontrollably, terrified. The bombers move closer, and he drops his rifle and tumbles into a foxhole. At the last minute, they turn away from his seemingly empty mountain to strike targets now farther and farther away. Soon it ends. The teenager who told his father as a boy he wanted to be a Japanese kamikaze pilot has never before witnessed the ferocity of American air power. He has watched much of a city disintegrate under a rain of American bombs and realizes what horror the people of Tokyo and Berlin must have endured in the last war. And what of all those poor people down below, he wonders, staring at the smoldering remnants of Chongjin. Chung Dong-kyu is down below, headed for the smoke and flames of central Chongjin. He and other students of the Chongjin Medical School bounce down the main road in a convoy of open trucks, hastily organized as a first aid corps responding to the devastating bombing. They drive as far as they can into the city. Rubble blocks the roads. The young men and women, given first aid kits of bandages, antiseptics, injectable morphine, and other items, are divided into teams of four or five and sent in every direction, wearing Red Cross armbands. The need must be great, Chung thinks, if the authorities are calling on untested medical students. He quickly sees the need is overwhelming. He first comes across a young woman crushed between two concrete slabs, her left arm neatly severed, her mouth agape, her dead eyes wide open, cast upward with a look of shock and surprise. The young student freezes at the sight of his first war casualty. His heart sinks. I hope she died instantly, he tells himself. Fanning out, the students see through the dust and smoke that hundreds of civilians lie dead or grievously wounded across the landscape of ruins. Many are legless or armless. Disemboweled intestines or shredded chunks of flesh lie beside bodies. Dust-covered heads or limbs protrude from among the piles of brick and plaster and wood. In a kind of daze, Chung and the others rush to wherever they hear screaming or sobbing. Other victims are found sitting silently in shock. They help some by cleaning, sterilizing, and bandaging wounds. But in many cases, all they can do is administer a morphine shot to trapped victims, while impromptu groups of local rescuers try to dig them out. For hours, the students dispense first aid as best they can using rudimentary knowledge and skills learned in the classroom and clinics. At sunset, city officials suspend the effort for the night. As the students are driven back to the school, Chung can see that in this city of 100,000 people, the extent of the destruction means countless injured will surely die before being pulled from the rubble. He has come face to face with the stunning cruelty of war. He feels a hatred building inside him for those who make it. Half a world away, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff informed General MacArthur in Tokyo they are sending him two more medium bomber groups, almost 200 planes. It is highly desirable to undertake mass air operations against North Korea, the Pentagon chiefs say. It is the beginning of a U.S. Air Force campaign that, in the months and years to come, levels cities and towns throughout the northern half of the peninsula. As a major port and iron and steel center, Changjin offered obvious industrial targets for this day's bombardiers. But the carpet bombing of this, the Americans' northernmost target city, has obliterated residential areas, schools, markets, and other non-military targets. Other raids follow, and the Air Force eventually estimates two-thirds of Changjin is destroyed. And so hope the aerial bombardment goes on. General MacArthur's order is to bomb every installation, factory, city, and village in North Korea. Now, in his final brief reading from Ghost Flames, Chen Shengchu is a 16-year-old medic in the Chinese Army. It's March of 1951, and he's part of a second wave of Chinese divisions that are entering the battle for Korea. They're moving only at night to hide from the American planes, of course, and during the day they camouflage themselves. They settle into the woods and camouflage themselves and sleep. This is just his unit's third overnight heading south to the war front. Now from the book. Despite the bumpy road, Chen is sleeping in the truck bed when he suddenly awakens to explosions. Off to the south, he sees flames in the night sky. Their truck reaches a crossroads where sentries tell them they're about to pass through a town newly bombed by the Americans and to watch for craters in the road and unexploded bombs. Entering the town, they see devastation everywhere, homes ablaze. The smoke burns their eyes. Then they hear the desperate voices of trapped women and children crying for help under collapsed walls and roofs. Korean rescue teams rush here and there. Moving on, the convoy halts at a bomb crater that has obliterated the roadway. The damage to surrounding houses seems total. The pleas Chen now hears from the trapped and wounded are the most pitiful yet. His instinct is to try to help, but he knows he cannot. They hear planes in the area. They must go. In the light of the fires, dozens of soldiers work quickly to clear brush from around the crater for a makeshift roadway. Soon they're rolling south again into the safety of the darkness, away from a heartbreaking scene that, 16-year-old Chen notes in his diary, left me with an unforgettable memory. The U.S. Air Force is engaged in a peak level of bombing from the Yalu River in the northwest to the port cities of North Korea's southeast. American pilots flew a record 850 sorties yesterday alone. Now, Hope, along with this peak level of Air Force bombing, the U.S. Navy has been shelling port cities like Wonsan in North Korea's southeast, the bomb city that Alan Winnington visited in the war's first days. The USS Missouri, the battleship, has fired thousands of shells into Wonsan. And an American admiral reports that, quote, Wonsan is a dead city. And there are still more than 2 years of war and bombing remaining. So back to you, Hope.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing those passages from Ghost Flames, which will be out in August, correct?
August 25 is the publication date.
All right. So there you have, you know, these different accounts, and I really appreciate the perspective of Ghost Flames, as you say. You're telling the story of the Korean War from the perspective of these 20 different people, and this is definitely in the spirit of Bertha von Suttner, who tried. She, you know, became famous, internationally famous, for a work of fiction that tried to tell the story of the horror of war through the perspective of a woman who lost various dear ones, and she became a leader of the peace movement, the 19th century peace movement, because of that work, as we've discussed. But so to just connect what we've said so far, there are stories that are deliberately hidden by governments and that hopefully are unearthed by archivists, historians, journalists. Pictures are extremely important in getting the record straight. But then we have to reckon with the way that we classify and describe these events, choosing the right adjectives, and telling these stories from the point of view of the people who suffer through them. I just wanted to connect what we have said to this point and ask anyone if they have anything to say in response to the passages that were just read from Ghost Flames.
I can build on it in some sense. The takeaway for me is rather one-pointed, and in order to get there, I'll reference, like, over in previous episodes, we've referred to this an article written by Elihu Root, titled "The Need for a Popular Understanding of International Law," and you know, it's dawned on me today that, you know, the first and foremost thing that a person needs to recognize, and the people listening and otherwise must do as a proper response to information like this, is to recognize that this is life for people. These are human beings. And when we, like, the very first step has to be the humanization of stories like this. And thankfully, the descriptions provided in Ghost Flames make it very difficult to remove the human element from the equation, which so often happens when we think about war and statistics. But yeah, like, we have a duty to recognize this as a human phenomenon, and that seems to fall into the category of a responsibility, as far as I can tell.
And it's fitting that, you know, you began this comment by talking about the Elihu Root article, "The Need for a Popular Understanding of International Law," and you end with humanization, because this is a movement within international law, the humanization of international law. And instead of international law governing states, making an enabling persons to be heard and be able to appeal to these international fora is a movement that is afoot. And I think it was Theodora Meron who did a series of lectures at the Hague Academy some years ago called The Humanization of International Law. Check it out, Google it, find it, educate yourself. Anybody else before we...
Yeah, I would just add on to Randy's point about the individualization. I think these stories, going back to like the carrying out of these tasks and the journalists who decided not to publish, like there's this individual responsibility beyond the state responsibility. And we can say the U.S. did this or whatnot, but it's important to know these stories. I think at one point we did speak about, you know, military training a couple episodes ago and how it's important to have that international humanitarian law. It's important to know these stories because people are the ones making the decisions, and if we don't learn from history, we can't make better decisions as individuals in the future.
Hear, hear. Michael, any last
thoughts? Well, and I would say to add to what Taylor just said, that as an old journalist, I can tell you that the first line of responsibility lies with journalism and journalists in reporting war, because I know too many stories, not just from the Korean War, but from other wars, and I've covered a number of them. Too many times things are covered up, and this is just really unfortunate, particularly for the American people, who seem to be so insulated from so much of what happens in the world and the reality of life in the rest of the world. And so, yes, journalists have a major responsibility to tell the truth.
Thanks for that. And Michael, anything?
I think Mr. Hanley's very human and personal accounts, bringing them to life, is highly important, especially when coming to, even in a practical standpoint, of leaders in power trying to make deals with different areas of the world. I think his one story in which the North Korean is just totally enraged and wants to just, as he said, murder, like the murderous dogs of the United States. That is rhetoric you hear from North Korea still today. And when you have a regime in power that has harnessed all of the pain and suffering that this entire population went through during the war and can then spin it and sort of hone it through propaganda, it really comes to be a toxic concoction in which the regime can then legitimize its horrendous acts. And I think through conversations I've had with family and friends who say, well, why does, like, I don't understand why North Korea hates us. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Well, when you come to read these accounts of just all the horrendous things that occurred, you can really start to gain a sense of why these people feel the way they do. And I think it would be important for people who would want to then deal with a regime which has dealt in really honing these stories to understand the places in which they are coming from as well.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I'll mention again, I think it's really important. I'm drawing on the work of Evelyn Lindner, who's written many books about humiliation in international relations, and that this is a real psychological fact that needs to be acknowledged, going back to the things that we've been saying in this show, that we have to, you know, in order to reconcile, we have to come to face with this what we have done and how this would be enraging and humiliating for a people, again, who had to live in holes in the ground, very small holes. So we have tried to bring to more consciousness the bombing of North Korea during the Korean War. We're kind of running out of time, but just quickly, if we could just maybe like have a couple minutes to talk about a critique of what we've been doing, which is criticizing the United States and these official histories that leave out important stories. Some have classified that as being un-American, and I remember like when I was in Korea, and people learned that I was interested in the Nogunri incident, they said, isn't that anti-American? And, well, it's the truth. So I just wanted to just open up the floor. I'll start with Taylor, and we'll just go around Taylor, and then Michael, and then Randy, and then Charlie. If you have anything to say about that critique of this being sort of unpatriotic or un-American to look at the misdeeds of the United States. Taylor, you want to start?
Yeah, I think this concept of true patriotism is very important because we have to look at ourselves to improve. And as an American, you want to improve your country. You want to you want this self-examination. To say it's un-American is kind of the opposite, especially like when you look at American discourse, like we have freedom of speech. Many democracies around the world have that as like a central component. Like that's our First Amendment. And so there is nothing I think more American than like calling out the U.S., you know, in this case in journalism and bringing these stories to life to share what the U.S. has done and therefore we can improve. If we're quiet about it, the U.S. never improves, and that's not a very American kind of pro-American stance. That kind of destroys our country.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Michael?
To quote what Mr. Hamlin said earlier, I think, and to also go what off Taylor said, that to truly have this Jesus Christ, this is my country moment is important. You have to have this full rounded picture of the area in which you live and the government that under which you live and the acts that it has committed. I think it is also important to know these darker sides of history, yourself to see yourself a citizen of the world and not just a citizen of one nation or one region. And through that, I think a great deal of cooperation and understanding would then flourish and with the hopeful eventual outcome being peace.
Thanks. And yeah, the citizen of the world, you know, that's a very ancient notion that you get from Stoic philosophy, the word cosmopolitan, literally meaning in Greek, citizen of the universe. And I also want to say that idea, it was a slogan of the Cosmopolitan Club, which was basically these clubs at universities trying to take forward the ideals of the peace through law movement. Above all nations is humanity. So these ideas were bandied about for a long time, and I think we're still trying to fully implement them. Randy?
So the main thing for me is that as, you know, U.S. citizens, we are reflecting, right? We're not just pointing to things and criticizing them. We're, in some sense, trying to take the person is like the maximum amount of personal responsibility as possible in the process of improving both ourselves and our nation. And for me, I know that I don't pretend to be perfect yet, and nor should the nation, right? The United States is not a flawless and, all things considered perfect entity. And part of imperfection is identifying where you are weak and where you must therefore improve. And so when it comes to the relationship between the United States and military activity, there is at least some room for improvement. And these are obvious examples of where, and they point to the horror of what occurs when we simply turn our backs or turn our heads away and don't look at the things that we've done and the things that we are continuing to do, because it's not like this stuff isn't still occurring all over the planet. It's just a different color now. And if we want to truly improve ourselves and move ourselves towards a perhaps grander version of ourselves, we cannot simply stay in a state of oblivion. We have to educate ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear. And Charlie, any final thoughts?
Yeah. You know, journalists have a cop-out when it comes to things like anti-Americanism or whatever, because a journalist simply says, my job is to tell the truth. My job is not to cover up the truth. And so when you're on the job, you don't think of yourself as an American or a Brit or a North Korean. Well, the North Korean journalists, I think, leave a lot to be desired. But as a first and foremost, a truth teller. That's what you're there for. Just like a doctor is a doctor, and not an American doctor or a British doctor. And you know, when it comes to patriotism, I just recently I've noticed more and more. There's such focus in the media, particularly on television, on the warriors, on the military, on the veterans, which is fine, you know, particularly for those who fought in wars to truly defend this country. But I wish my old colleagues in the media would focus more on people who are campaigning for peace in the world, and more on what the United Nations is doing to bring stability and prosperity and such to various parts of the world, and not just reporting on our glorious warriors. Mm-hmm. But patriotism is in the eye of the beholder, I guess, and for me it's you know, America's accomplishments in science and in literature and even popular culture, the better parts of it, that's what we can be proud of.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so much food for thought. I learned so much. So we are out of time. Next week we will likely be continuing this conversation on the Korean War, but looking at the psychological warfare. It's also not a very well-known story, so we hope that will be our next show soon. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Charlie, so much for being with us for the last 3 weeks.
To be with you.
I learned so much, and I look forward to reading your book. And thank you all, and you have been listening to Virtues of Peace. If y'all want to say goodbye, now is your chance. Bye.
Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Good,
until
goodbye.
Next time. Bye.